Welcome to The Collection. On this week's show, Andrew Bell, CEO of Regency Mines.
Some of the things being said about the opinions of the royal family may be correct, but I wouldn't be surprised if other members of the royal family had diametrically opposite views, and I don't think anyone is going to be influenced in their vote by that.
Chris Bailey, European strategist for Financial Orbit.
I'm strongly of the opinion that Say's Law, supply creates its own demand, and the development of Europe over the next generation or two is going to be based largely on immigration and all the positives from that.
An economist, Rachel Winter from Killick.
The idea of buying a house just seems so unachievable that people don't even try and they just spend all their money on holidays and
I'm just hoping that I will die before the time comes. So, you know, live fast, die young. I've lived fast, but I haven't died young yet, unfortunately.
Still waiting.
In a time when we are used to shocks, there were sponsorship opportunities going begging from Tag Heuer, Porsche and Nike after pin-ups tennis star Maria Sharapova confessed to having taken meldonium even after its recent ban. It was perhaps less of a surprise that former President Lula of Brazil was charged with money laundering, or that Her Majesty the Queen was leaked by The Sun, allegedly via Michael Gove, as being anti-EU. Gove denies being the leaker. The palace denies everything. The Queen, at least officially, remains resolutely neutral. In fact, the referendum campaign, or Project Fear as it is now more popularly known, rumbled on, with Bank of England Governor Mark Carney getting in on the act in front of a committee of MPs. By some quirk of fate, his inquisitors seemingly included some of the most Eurosceptic people around, including Jacob Rees-Mogg. This rather gave Mr. Carney no place to hide as far as attempting to finesse the bank's independence from a pro-EU government. Meanwhile, one of the reasons for joining the EU in the 1970s was hoped to be that some of the more unsavoury aspects of rip-off Britain might be extinguished. Unfortunately, this has not happened so far, with the risk that loyal customers of energy companies face a barrage of cold calls from rival firms to the ones they are currently with. Meanwhile, in the financial markets, the wait for the next likely dose of QE and low interest rates was finally over for Mario Draghi, the ECB president. He beat expectations with his actions. The aftermath of this could decide whether or not the recent stock market recovery will continue. So far, it would appear that the January-February stock market sell-off was something of a sucker move and actually a buying opportunity of rare quality. The Queen in the news today, folks, she's insisted that she's politically neutral. Do we believe her? Andrew Bell.
Well, if the Queen says she's politically neutral, she's politically neutral. It's not correct that anybody should be reporting her private conversations because there's no possible way that she can respond to it, say what her views really are. And I think a bad precedent was set when she responded to pressure, perhaps from Downing Street, and made some throwaway remark before the Scottish referendum, because now it's open season. But much better that that gets put back in its box and doesn't happen.
But why can't she just be a normal person, like, you know, and be allowed to speak and make mistakes and say things in public? And
because she's queen.
but that concept, isn't that a little bit outdated now?
I don't think so. One of the problems America has is the head of state and head of government are the same person. So people have great divisions in their minds at the time when they were impeaching Clinton. But they said, how can we impeach the commander-in-chief? Doesn't it weaken America? It's better, in a way, to have the head of state as a symbolic figure who doesn't give opinions than a head of government who's separate.
But I don't know how symbolic her power is. I mean, she does seem to have a lot of influence. I mean, as far as we discuss this matter, you know, with reference to the Queen and Brexit, one has to have a sort of little proviso and say that the palace has insisted the Queen is politically neutral and has referred the matter to IPSO and the Independent Press Standards Organisation. So, you know, we've got this power thing. You know, the power of the palace is still upon us. It's like 1700 or something.
Anybody can refer something to IPSO. I think probably some of the things being said about the opinions of the royal family may be correct, but I wouldn't be surprised if other members of the royal family had diametrically opposite views, and I don't think anyone is going to be influenced in their vote by that.
But isn't it, doesn't it, sort of, it's almost obvious to say that the Queen is sovereign, and she would not be happy if the EU took away some of her sovereignty? So she can't be neutral. There's no way that she could be neutral. If we went into a United States of Europe, she would be, her power would be reduced and diminished.
You may well say that.
Okay. Chris Bailey, what do you think of the situation here?
So, you know, let's put this into historical context. Ever since we had Mr. Cromwell, the Queen or the King's power has been clearly subordinate at a certain level to that of Parliament. And that's totally appropriate for a full democracy. But we all know that the Queen has private audiences with the Prime Minister and senior Privy Cabinet members. She gives opinions there. And you read any of the old historic autobiographies from politicians from the past, and they all say the Queen has some very firm views and is not shy in expressing them. I think where clearly there's an embarrassment is that there's been an attempt to give an external, very clear steer of her view, and she much prefers to work behind the scenes. That is the ultimate power of the Queen. She pulls the strings behind the scenes, prefers not to show up herself with an explicit and clear view. But does she have an opinion? Absolutely.
Yes, but this country is a parliamentary democracy. Really, the Queen shouldn't have any say in, or even influence, or even behind-the-scenes activity going on.
But the Queen is, in itself, she and her the royal family are a huge generator of assets and wealth and prestige for this country. And as a consequence, because of a ceremonial role, an important historic role, and also as, a great asset for the country, they should be able to give an opinion. The fact that they can have access to the Prime Minister and other leading cabinet members is a particular form of individual influence that they have. But yes, I'm sure they give their views behind the scenes.
So that's two out of two on the pro-establishment front. Rachel Winter, where do you stand on this?
Well, I'm sure she does have her own opinion, but I think it probably is safer for her to appear to remain neutral. I think there are probably lots of people in the UK who just have no idea how to vote, and they're looking to celebrities and people in the public eye to try and inform their own opinion. So I think it probably is safer for the Queen to stay out of it and encourage people to perhaps look more towards true financial experts.
Like yourself.
Such as myself, yeah.
Right.
For example, Boris Johnson has come out with his own opinion, and I know a lot of people are looking to him to form their own opinion.
I'd rather look to you, actually, I have to say, I think the man's a buffoon. Getting away from the Queen, because I think, you know, I have to say I don't agree with the whole setup. I think it's the worst of both worlds. She's not allowed to give her opinion, but she's got to remain neutral. I'd rather hear a true opinion or hear no opinion, but this sort of farce that we have at the moment seems to be an unsustainable middle ground, which is just not, you know, which I don't think, I think it will unravel anyway over the near term, courtesy of the Sun newspaper, good people. Right, Brexit, we've got this alleged project fear going on as far as what's going to happen if we leave. Stock market had a wobble at the beginning of the year. The sterling definitely had a wobble a few weeks ago. That seems to have gone away. Rachel, do you think that Brexit will prove to be a sort of a red herring going forward?
My personal view, not my firm's view, I have to say, is that we'll probably stay in. I think there are a lot of people in the UK who perhaps want to stay in, but they're not really being that outspoken about it because they don't really think it's that likely that we will leave. At the moment, I think the people who want to leave Europe are being the more outspoken.
Right, and that sort of makes sense that they would, because it's a sort of, they're trying to change people's minds.
Where they are. They're trying to step away from the norm.
Right. Andrew Bell, what's your view on the EU situation and the Brexit? Have we got ourselves into an unnecessary mess?
Well, I think that the Prime Minister and the government have made a mistake in making so much of the dire consequences that could follow if we leave, because it means that if the vote is no, they won't be in a position to negotiate very successfully. Nobody will trust them to do so. And also, they may bring on the very consequences, both before and after the referendum, that they speak about by unsettling markets and making people think that it's all going to be terrible outside, which quite clearly isn't the case.
But the real risk is that the government falls after a no Brexit vote, and then the sterling collapse and all the other issues that were there a few weeks ago will start coming in. Boris Johnson will be trying to become Prime Minister. All this sort of stuff, well, he already is, but I mean, just all this sort of stuff will come out of the woodwork.
I don't see any reason why sterling should collapse.
Well, it would if Prime Minister Corbyn comes in and sort of taxes everybody at 90%.
Well, I think the overwhelming likelihood is that the party with the majority in Parliament, the Conservatives, would remain in power because they are the party most closely identified with the Brexit cause.
Chris Bailey, do you have a similar view to that?
Some of you on the legitimacy of the vote, I think it's an absolutely wise thing every generation to have a referendum on a huge issue such as Europe. We saw it initially in the mid-1970s when the whole concept of the EEC was being discussed and reviewed. I think it's totally appropriate to have it. It does cause a lot of issues and schisms and related. In terms of the core debate, it seems to me we have a choice between what I would describe as the certainty of frustration of continued membership, the fact that there are harmonisation efforts which clearly puts people's backs up and inefficiencies and other related costs, versus the sort of unclear and uncertain outcome of exiting. And I think it's right that the people should give a view. It certainly raises the bar. It certainly raises the issues. It does raise the risks for economic growth. But on something like this, which has a huge structural impact on our economy going forward and, frankly, Europe's economy as well, it's right and proper that there should be a referendum.
But is it? Oh, sorry. Yes, Rachel.
So I think that uncertainty you mentioned is really the key issue here, because no one knows what would happen if we left. We have no idea what the terms would be between Britain and Europe if we were to leave. So we don't really know what we're voting for. And I think a lot of people will say the devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
Yeah, I would concur with that. And I think that the status quo argument is the one which is the most compelling. Of course, you look at the potential outcomes from an exit scenario and you think about the potential for, in an ideal world, to strike free trade agreements with a variety of other countries or economic zones. And it could, from a purely economically theoretical perspective, be wonderful and hugely accretive to the UK economy, enhance our position and our wealth. But we just don't know. And as you say, Rachel, I think inevitably when there are other people involved, it gets a bit sort of game theoretic, back to those game theory models and
yeah,
related. And the reality, as far as I can see it, is that there would be risks in an exit, negative risks for UK economic growth, but also the same for Europe, a reduction in trade because of uncertainty over legislation and regulation and related is not good for anyone. So it's a lose-lose then. This is why, in my opinion, personally, I would be in favour of remaining within the European Union. I love a liberal view. I love low government. I love structural reform and competitiveness. We haven't got that in Europe at the moment. That should be the debate, not the membership.
I don't quite buy that argument about uncertainty over how trade would continue. First of all, under the Treaty of Lisbon, it's a requirement that the EU has close relations with all its neighbours. Secondly, there's a two-year, if you invoke Chapter 50 of the treaty and start negotiations, that's a two-year process. Additionally, if we were to leave, we used to belong to EFTA. All the countries in EFTA, with the exception of Switzerland, have signed the EEA agreement with the EU countries, which gives free trade and continues a lot of the arrangements. A country which is outside that, like Norway, participates in about 20 programs and other agencies of the EU and makes a contribution in connection with that. And also, because it's 70% richer than us per head, it makes a contribution as part of its aid budget to Eastern European countries, which it, by the way, administers wholly itself. So people who say that's one of the costs that Norway bears are getting it wrong. Or we could have a relationship like Sweden. But frankly, it wouldn't matter, as Andrew Neil was saying on Politics Today a few days ago. There is free trade in Europe from the extreme north to the extreme south. And the only country that is not included in that is Belarus. And if we left, we must assume that that would be there. And frankly, even if we were paying tariffs, it wouldn't matter because EU tariffs are only 4%, and the EU tariffs to countries with GDPs of over 1.6%, of over $5,000 a year, are only 1.6%. So it's agricultural tariffs where the EU punishes countries.
OK, well, let's just slightly change the focus there. I think that in the internet age and global communication and everything else, this tariffs and trade thing is very, very 70s, and I think that's not quite the issue now. You can contact anybody in Belarus and, you know, sell them a telephone or you know, buy one from there. That doesn't seem to be too much of an issue. What is an issue, and it hasn't been played so much in the media even now, is immigration. We've got 300,000 people coming to the country every year, a sort of 1,000 a day. As a son of a migrant, I'm obviously sensitive to these issues. And, you know, the situation has totally changed since the 70s and the last vote. That, for me, if I wanted to win the Brexit vote, I'd just say, you know, we get the Brexit and there's a moratorium on immigrants for 5 years. It's a bit of a Trump policy, I admit, until we sort ourselves out, until we can take up that spare, or we can develop extra capacity. That's a serious point, and I think really this country would be better if we got hold of our borders again. For me, a country with open borders is not a country. The whole point of a country is a place with borders, which obviously Greece is finding out at the moment. So, Chris Bailey, immigration.
So, I take very much a sort of a market mechanism view on this. My perception is that immigration is a net positive. I think history has shown that. You just look at the development of the United States being clearly the best example. But Europe's, and I'll talk about, you know, pan-Europe, it's not so much an issue in the UK, but pan-Europe, there's a huge demographic problem. Essentially, population growth is low. They actually need immigration to fill the gaps. And I'm strongly of the opinion that Say's Law, supply creates its own demand, is absolutely essential for the development of economies. And the development of Europe over the next generation or two is going to be based largely on immigration and all the positives from that.
So, for every Oxford University study, every 1% increase in migrants, the average wage is lowered by 0.3%. I would imagine every 100,000 people who come to this country every year would add on 2% to the house price index. I mean, are you happy with that?
But it's using the market mechanism. And the problem we have here, housing is a great example, the inability of people to build sufficient houses. There are companies out there to build them, more than adequate skills to do that. Why aren't they doing that? And the reason they're not doing that is excessive planning regulations. Liberalise those and you will solve the problem. The market mechanism always works and supply creates its own demand. And I would apply that to immigration too, in the sense that people coming into the country, my view would be, if you can support yourself, if you can prove that you've got a job or that you've got a period of time to search for one whilst you're supporting yourself, allow people in. I'd have open borders. That is how you develop an economy.
We're literally letting anybody in, whether they've got skills or not. They're just here for the welfare benefits and everything else.
No welfare benefits. You support yourself for a period of 2 years to see how you get on.
Within the EU, you're obliged to take anybody who turns up across the English Channel.
But this is the issue with Europe. And this is mentioned earlier, the fact that Europe's big challenge is that it's insufficiently dynamic. And if it wants to solve its longer-term issues of a lack of growth relative to the states, a lack of dynamism within its own regional borders, it needs to liberalise the supply side. That is the key. And that includes accepting mass immigration, but also accepting the market mechanism across a wider variety of business life and social life.
Andrew Bell?
Well, when we talk about the EU and mass immigration, of course, we're not talking about one country with a commonality of values and loyalties that a country has. We're talking about the EU, where the unemployment pay per hour in some parts is a tenth or a sixth of what it is in the UK. So it's an illusion to think that these immigrants are going to want to come to the countries of Eastern Europe. They'll all be sucked into the countries that they see as most prosperous. They'll pick and choose. And although you've made a good argument for having controls on the extent to which you allow people to draw on the state for benefits and so on for the first couple of years, that's not on the agenda. Any attempts to negotiate that failed. And supposedly, if we failed in negotiating that, we were going to leave the EU. So even with that threat, we didn't get it out of the EU. Without that threat, how will we ever get it? 1.2 million people claiming to be refugees went to Germany last year. first 2 months of this year, despite all the talk about closing borders, the rate has been exactly the same, 200,000. A police report has leaked in Germany saying they're getting hundreds and hundreds of incidents of Salafi preachers trying to make contact with people in the refugee camps. And 70% or so of the people who went into Germany are young men who will then want to have their families or follow them. And if the precedent of, for example, the Somali influx as refugees into Europe is anything to go by, once they get their papers in the Somali case in Sweden, Holland and Italy, a lot of them then migrate straight to England. I myself have had Uber drivers, and I'm sure you have, who spent some years in Germany and have now come to London. And I say, why did you come to England? They said, well, the English language is important. We wanted our children educated here. So Frau Merkel has actually opened the taps into this country after a few years as well. The only protection we have is to get out of these arrangements and protect what is. England is the most densely populated country in Europe after Malta.
It's such a difficult one, it really is. And I think there's a big moral issue here. And you can see that with the fact that people in Germany were campaigning to have more immigration last year, and that turned around very quickly, and now people are protesting against Merkel and saying they've had too much immigration. And I think people do, they do see their own countries as overpopulated, and they do hate the thought of people sort of capitalising on their own welfare payments. But then people do look at people being homeless and struggling in their own countries, like Syria and Somalia, and they do want to help them out. So some people would vote in favour of immigration for that reason.
I think this migration crisis, which it is, for me, it's like somebody should be saying, no, you know, don't come here. You know, it's not a good idea. We're full, et cetera, et cetera. It's a crisis of, I suppose, liberal values and liberal values. The irony is liberal values here, but the people who are coming over don't have liberal values. They have very, very right-wing values. They are very cynical. There's all these other, they have different perspectives about the charity of the West. And as I said, coming from that background myself, I can see the two sides, painfully clearly. As I said, full stop or at least a comma on migration has to be the answer in the near term until somebody can work out the best way forward. But the best way forward is not the current situation.
Would you find, Zach, that a lot of the people who came from Pakistan and India and so on in previous generations are actually very anti this immigration today?
My parents came here in 65. Their goal was that I would be, they loved the British values. Obviously, they'd been under colonial rule. They came here on the basis that they obviously loved it under the colonial rule so much they wanted to go back to the mother country. So that is a sort of a vote of confidence for the British way of life, and they wanted me to be like Prince Charles, and I've nearly achieved it. Same hairstyle, same accent.
Yeah.
Let's just to finish off. Let's get on to something which is the best of British, the budget. Which is coming up next week. Just wanted to flag some of the things coming up or which are alleged to be coming up. Andrew Oxlade from The Telegraph says that we should watch out for the lifetime allowance, an annual allowance on pension contributions, which may also be changed, increasing the personal allowance and expecting more detail on how the main residence allowance on inheritance tax will work from 2017. Rachel Winter, any stock market friendly or unfriendly developments coming through in the budget, do you think?
I think the pension reform is really the main thing that people are concerned about. And the fact that we don't know what's going to happen with pensions, we don't know if people are going to continue to get tax relief when they put money into their pension, we just don't know what's going to happen. And that makes people very uncertain and very nervous about having their money in a pension. So at Killick & Co, where I work at the moment, we are seeing a lot of people taking as much money out of their pension as they can as early as possible, just because they do not feel confident about the current pension regulation.
And the obvious thing is that we are in a demographic time bomb. We're in a pensions disaster area as well. There's not going to be enough money, you know, a lot of people are going to be in difficulties when they're in their old age. At the moment, well, you tax when you put money in, you tax when you take money out, you tax when it's there. I mean, it's tax everywhere. I mean, isn't it a disaster?
At the moment, you get a tax credit when you put money in, and then you are taxed when you take the money out. They're looking at reversing that. So they're looking at taxing you on the way in and then not taxing you on the way out. Whether or not that happens is another thing, but that's...
You live to get the money out.
Exactly, yeah. But I think pensions are a key issue at the moment. And the amount of saving that people my age or people in their 30s are doing is so worrying. I mean, I don't really know anyone who's saving a sufficient amount in their pension at the moment.
We all have our houses, don't we? And we are houses which we can sell off, you know, when we get old.
A lot of people don't. A lot of people can't even afford to buy a house. So they've got no house, they've got no pension. The idea of buying a house just seems so unachievable that people don't even try, and they just spend all their money on holidays and
yeah.
And
I'm just
like
hoping that I will die before the time comes. So, you know, live fast, die young. I've lived fast, but haven't died young yet, unfortunately.
Still waiting.
Andrew, what do you think?
Well, I think that when house prices rose so much in the sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, and once interest rates started coming down, interest rates starting to come down meant that the actuarial rate of return was going to come right down. So even though it meant house prices were going up, what people should have done is not put that money into enlarging their houses or increasing their houses. They should have increased their pension contributions because people are living longer. And in old age, a lot of people, even people who save, will be destitute. For the government then to go in when the actuarial rate of return has gone down, when people are living longer, and start taxing pensions on the view that people won't notice for a few decades strikes me as completely stupid and short-sighted, because eventually a lot more people are going to be dependent on the state.
Chris, it's
the five-year political cycle, unfortunately. Pensions are a longer-term issue, and so no government has really grasped it aggressively and coherently, because the payoffs, the positive payoffs, if there are any, come way after those politicians have retired. I actually think George Osborne's biggest challenge is going to be the fiscal side, because he's got a problem in that the economy is not growing quite as fast as people thought. The budget deficit control, which he hoped for, is hence a bit more difficult to achieve. He's got to balance all of those issues. I think whilst there will be some, no doubt, eye-catching tax changes, we're still too early in this parliamentary cycle to give away too much. There's got to be more austerity, but not enough in order to quell any economic growth stroke recovery that we've got. It's a fine balancing act. The end result, I think, will be we're not going to hit these budget deficit reduction targets, and Britain's still going to have a budget deficit over the balance of this decade.
Yeah, but who cares? I mean, the interest rates are practically zero. I mean, you can have a budget deficit of trillions. It doesn't make any difference, does it?
Yeah, and therein lies the biggest challenge for the bond markets, number one, and the fact that you've got this juxtaposition of no country around the world having proper fiscal sort of balance, apart from possibly Germany, but maybe they're spending that as discussed on their immigration and related policy, and negative or low-yielding bond markets. You know, it's a fascinating tension between those two, which is going to spill over in a pretty dramatic fashion over the balance of this decade. My top tip, bond yields are going to go up eventually. A bit of inflation will come back. Stick with equities.
But then a lot of people are going to be ruined, aren't they? I mean, then the real estate bubble will burst.
Well, yes and no, because as an alternative asset, real estate may have some potential. I would agree. You look at the valuation metrics in, let's say, London, it doesn't make any sense. But across a sort of a broader sort of pan-European perspective, just maybe it does. I think more interesting is going to be the fact that when you think about how, unfortunately, bonds are so, you know, lowly valued at the moment in terms of their yields and the lack of value there, it's just going to be pushing you again towards equities. So thinking about pension allocations, that is where you should be focused on. Individual companies doing interesting things, there's still plenty of those around.
Just finally, Andrew Bell, you're the CEO of Regency Mines. We seem to have a flash of hope in the resources and the commodities space. Is it going to last?
Well, I think that gold has actually been strong against every currency except the US dollar, which has been the strongest currency for a year or two. What's happened is moved from number two to number one early this year, and suddenly everyone's noticed. Yeah, it's up about 18%. Over the same period from January, oil has risen 35%. Copper, nickel have risen sharply. Iron ore has more or less doubled, and manganese has done the same. And we know that because we're involved in manganese production. Is this Chinese recovery? Is it just that it was oversold? Or is it there was a process of destocking that's now come to an end? I wish I had the answers to those things, but the only thing I can say with some feeling, and having listened to some of us today, I think I'd say more strongly, is it's probably a good thing to have a little bit of gold in your portfolio.
Right. So the ECB, as we were just before we came on air, have come up with another bazooka of easing and fiscal stimulus. That should help the commodities area?
Well, ultimately, the growth in the commodities area over the years from 2003-2004 has been as a result of the rapid industrialization of China. That was much the most important factor. That is has been undoing, and unless you understand what's happening in the Chinese economy, and you can't really trust all the statistics, it's quite difficult to make long-term forecasts for any of these commodities.
I make a point of believing all the Chinese statistics. It cheers me up no end. Andrew Bell, Chris Bailey and Rachel Winter, thank you very much. With thanks to Andrew Bell, Chris Bailey and Rachel Winter, this has been The Collection. I'm Zach Meir.